apologetics. You'll see like an awful lot of just notes, typed notes, which is also in the other booklet that I gave you, the smaller one. And then as you move forward, you'll get to there's an introduction to apologetics PowerPoint, and you've got to turn a few pages from there. That gives you just kind of an overview. We don't have time to cover it. But the biblical basis for apologetics, this is what it looks like.
There's a page number on top of the
page. The problem is once we get past the first, I don't know how many pages, there are no page numbers. So it's really, it's really crazy, but I could explain the dynamics of that, but it would just bore you to no end.
Biblical basis and all that?
Yeah. In fact, but let's go a few pages before that. Right there. Yeah.
We're looking at one third to the left.
Yeah, right there. See, we got it. Good.
Okay. Up there, you're in the ballpark.
All right, so
I need you in the ballpark.
All right, so now what we want to talk about, now we're starting, we gave our little overview, now we're going to introduce apologetics. And so the first thing we're going to do is we're going to define it, and I'm just going to give you a real simple definition here. Apologetics is the defense of the Christian faith. And you could call it the rational defense of the Christian faith, as long as you don't mean by rational, only using reason. If you just mean rational in a more general sense, you can call it the rational defense of the faith. And it's going to involve both, some would call it positive apologetics, defending the Christian faith, and negative apologetics, refuting false beliefs or false religions. So apologetics is the defense of the Christian faith. And just to give you a fuller understanding, maybe confuse you a bit, but I've got listed here different ways to defend the Christian faith. And I'm going to write down on the board some we usually call it classical apologetics and evidentialism. Classical and evidential. But if we just look at it, apologetics as arguing, you know, if you want to, apologists want to argue to God, argue from something else to God. So let me put that down. Argue from something to God. And classical apologetics would fall into that category, which is usually what this is philosophical arguments for God, and then historical evidences. Okay? Evidential apologetics gets right into historical, but it might also then turn later on to arguments for God. So they're so closely related, I find it almost comical when an evidentialist like Gary Habermas is debating a classical apologist like William Lane Craig, when Craig openly admits that sometimes it's okay to argue for Jesus first and then God later. I mean, it's just two different kind of two slightly different flavors of vanilla, but it's still vanilla, okay? And, but you can add, so now, right now, with modern science, there's what I call like scientific apologetics that you're arguing from something in creation to the creator, okay? Let me see what other ones, you've got, cumulative case, apologetics, where there's some guys who argue from something to God, but they like lots of different, they like lots of different evidences that accumulate. They don't like to put all their eggs in one basket. You also get something similar. Some guys like using more than not just a lot of different evidences, but there's like combinational apologetics where they like to combine different branches of evidence, but they're still arguing from something to God. Let me see. The dialogical apologetics, man. With dialogical, David Clark, all he's doing is taking classical apologetics, but he's saying, look, let's not be so nitpicky that we have to do it exactly the way Augustine or Aquinas did it. And we can use this, we can use this, we can use this. Let's have a cumulative case approach, but let's make it person-centered. Whoever we're dialoguing with, if the guy you're dialoguing with is an engineer, he's probably going to be more open to scientific evidences than maybe a guy who's studying classical literature. Okay? But let's make the apologetics appropriate to the person. Then again, you might find a mathematician who could care less about evidences. Well, Clark would say, okay, well, let's find out what makes this guy tick, okay? And sometimes I even think it shouldn't even be classified as an approach. It's just good, common, practicalist advice for apologists to use, but he calls it his own branch of it. So here you can see, arguing from something to God, you got a lot of different ways that you can do that. But then there's others that say it's blasphemous to argue from something to God. That's idolatry. You have to argue from God to everything else. He's the creator. He has to come first. This is the argument of the presuppositionalist. They presuppose God's existence. The ones who are really presuppositionalists, I will go on record, they're Christian brothers, but they are some of the most arrogant people in the Christian church, and sometimes they do a lot of damage when somebody denies God's existence. If you're going to start with what they deny, good luck. But now most of them do tend to be 5-point Calvinists. So there are a lot of them are claiming that. By the way, you get a 5-point Calvinist like R.C. Sproul, that's a classical apologist. But these guys over here, it's like either God regenerates you or he doesn't. So their defending the faith almost becomes a proclaiming of the faith. And it's actually, I don't want to go into great depth here because we will spend a few classes on this when we get to advanced apologetics and apologetic methodologies in a later course that I'll be teaching at Shepherd's Bible College. But first off, it's a category mistake. And I don't want to lose anybody on this, but what the presuppositionalist is doing is they're confusing I'll give you the big words and then I'll explain what it means. The confusing epistemological priority with metaphysical priority. Big category mistake for philosophers to do this. Epistemology is one branch of philosophy. It deals with knowledge. Can man know? What can man know? How can we know? Metaphysics deals, is the branch of philosophy that deals with reality, with the realm of being. Okay? Just because the classical apologist starts with something in the realm of knowledge that he'll say to the non-believer, well, you know the physical world exists. It had to have a cause. There's design in the, you know there's design in the universe. It had to have a designer. You know there's real absolute moral laws above all people, all cultures. Doesn't change with time. There's got to be a moral lawgiver above all people, all cultures. Doesn't change with time. So, but they're saying that in the realm of knowledge, something else might come first, and then you might say, well, if this, if finite things exist, limited things exist, then an infinite, unlimited being must exist to ground their existence. So just because in the realm of knowledge they might come first, doesn't mean you're saying that their existence, their reality is more important than God's. Okay? But to the presuppositionalist, if you start with, if you start with the physical world and then argue to God, you might as well break out a golden calf. Okay? So I find it very difficult to talk to these guys. Having said that, there are a lot of young apologists that love Van Til, Cornelius Van Til, love Gordon Clark, and they call themselves presuppositionalists, and they don't realize a true presuppositionalist says, my way or the highway. So I've got a Canadian, brilliant Canadian friend, John Feeks, heads Care Ministries in Winnipeg, Canada. If you don't know where that is, that's, it's where they spell the word defense wrong. They use a C. And an old English teacher, when I wear the sweatshirt that he gave me, all the English teachers stop me in the hall and say the word is spelled wrong. And I say, not in Winnipeg. But he's about 10 years younger than me. He's a former, I'm a former boxer. He's a former mixed martial arts, full contact karate guy. So he really liked me, listened to hundreds of my lectures, and started his apologetics ministry. Then I mentored him in a master's degree in apologetics or in religion through Columbia Evangelical Seminary. Brilliant guy, takes debates, speaks publicly. He calls himself a presuppositionalist, but he likes and uses William Lane Craig's Kalam cosmological argument for God, which is everything that has a beginning needs a cause, the universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. In other words, he's not really a presuppositionalist. I'm a classical apologist who loves presuppositional arguments. But if I only love Vantillian presuppositional arguments, I'm not allowed to love anybody else's if I'm really a presuppositionalist. So when it comes down to presuppositionalists, you have Van Til and his transcendental argument. Oh, the two points I wanted to make. For the presuppositionalists, first they make a category mistake. They confuse epistemological priority with metaphysical priority. Just because Nathaniel knew Philip before he knew Jesus doesn't mean that he considered Philip more important than Jesus. Once Philip led Nathaniel to Jesus, Jesus took on the metaphysical priority. Okay? So if something other than God leads you to God, it doesn't make that other something more important than God. You're not an idolater. Okay? And these guys love name calling, anybody who disagrees with them. The other thing is they claim their view comes from the Bible. This is the only biblical way to defend the faith. Well, then why did Jesus give many convincing proofs? According to Luke. Is Jesus an idolater? He pointed to proofs to prove that he had risen from the dead. Jesus said in John chapter 10, if you don't believe my words, believe my works. Believe me because of my miracles. Jesus was doing classical and evidential apologetics. Okay? And but they claim their view is very biblical. In reality, there would be no presuppositional apologetics if it wasn't for post-Kantian skepticism. David Hume began to attack the traditional arguments for God's existence, and then Immanuel Kant finished the job. And after that, it was like a who's who's list in Western philosophy. If you held to the traditional arguments for God's existence, you were thought to be outdated, because Immanuel Kant, he was the man. Okay? So but basically what I'm saying is, if these guys, you want to give these guys credit, give them credit for backing down to Immanuel Kant. Don't give them credit for being truer to the Bible. God's always, you know, God's going to demonstrate to Pharaoh that Moses is his guy. Okay? This guy just said, well, I'm God, and I just said he's my guy, so just accept it. Because I got no argument better than myself. No, God says, hey, he needs evidence? We'll give him the 10 plagues. That's not enough? I'll part the Red Sea. Okay? Signs and wonders. God starts writing the Old Testament. Signs and wonders. He starts writing the New Testament. Signs and wonders. We got a good God. God that gives us so much evidence. The resurrection not only gives us the empty tomb, he gives us the risen Savior to appear in the upper room while the doors are locked. God's into giving us evidence. Jesus, before Jesus was even born, he had hundreds of prophecies, predictions that he was going to fulfill. God's into giving evidence. When Van Til, you're only allowed, all you can do is refute the non-Christian and then give his one transcendental argument and saying that basically God exists, therefore there's morality, there's meaning in life, there's truth, our reason works. Well, that's a good argument, but it can go both ways. You can go from God to morality, or from morality to God. They only allow it one way. Gordon Clark, was dogmatic presuppositionalism. Gordon Clark tested, he was probably one of the greatest philosophers of the 20th century. Died in, I think, 1985. And, but he Gordon Clark, he showed that, you know, okay, let's say truth is found through the five senses, okay? And you can take a pen, and the five senses tell us this pen is straight. But if you put it in water, the five senses tell us that it's not straight, it's bent. And Gordon Clark argues there's nothing in the world of senses that can determine which way it is. We make a judgment that when we put it in the water, that that kind of brings the confusion into play. But the senses can be mistaken. We can mistakenly interpret the senses. Gordon Clark goes so far, he only accepts deductive arguments that bring absolute certainty. So he believes science just finds formulas that work. You find no truth in science. No truth can be found through the five senses. Very rarely will you find a Christian who holds his views. Okay? And, but basically, he says all that works is reason. The problem is, reason's got to start somewhere. Okay? So reason, we can reason that all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. If the premises are true, the conclusion has to be true. So reason is the way to find truth. Problem is, how do we know that all men are mortal? And so you might say, well, maybe if we can prove our first principles to through reason alone, then rationalism will work. The problem is, if your first principles, if you have reasons for believing them, they're not your, they're your first principles. The principles before them are. And then those you would have to prove through reason alone. So you can't prove, Gordon Clark shows, you can't prove everything through reason alone. It's got to stop somewhere. So he says, guess what? You got to dogmatically presuppose your first principle. And then we'll deduce everything from that. By the way, early Gordon Clark was dogmatic presuppositionalism. I love it. He uses the law of non-contradiction, refutes opposing belief systems. But he says, he's refuting other belief systems and says, look, I just dogmatically presuppose the existence of the triune God who has revealed himself in the scriptures, and he is a logical God, so I presuppose the law of non-contradiction. What Clark called the law of contradiction, A cannot equal non A at the same time, it's the same way. Okay? This cannot both be a bottle of water and not a bottle of water at the same time, the same way. Okay? And so he uses that, I think, as a powerful way to defend the faith. And it even seemed like he was okay with a little bit of confirmation. It's the only presupposition that makes sense out of reality. So the early Gordon Clark, that's a powerful way to defend the faith. Unfortunately, because he couldn't believe, he couldn't find any truth through the five senses, he eventually, later Clark, his view became scripturalism. Now, sola scriptura, one of the five solas of the Reformation, the Bible alone, what that means is the Bible alone is the final authority for our beliefs and our behavior. Okay? Sola scriptura never meant truth is only found in the scriptures. Because the scriptures tell us that God reveals truth to us about himself through our consciences, through creation. Okay?
So what does it mean? Sorry.
Sola scriptura means the Bible alone is the final authority for what we believe and how we behave. It's what makes Protestants Protestants and not Roman Catholics. Now, unfortunately, a lot of Protestants therefore don't have any interest in the writings and the teachings of the Church Fathers, and I think that's wrong. We should respect the Church Fathers, study their writings, but test it with the Scripture. And the Roman Catholic Church is the Bible plus Church tradition. Oh, and by the way, the only ones who could interpret the Bible are the teaching arm, the teaching magisterium of the Roman Catholic Church. So in the end, the Bible gets swallowed up by church tradition. But sola scriptura meant the Bible is the sole authority for faith and practice. It doesn't mean the Bible is the only place where we can find truth. But that's what Clark, eventually his view, because he had no trust in the world of the senses. So eventually scripturalism, truth can only be found in the scriptures. And so he was asked once, I believe he was lecturing at Dallas Theological Seminary, and he was slamming my old professor Norm Geisler. And one of Geisler's students asked him, how can you presuppose the Bible? How do you even know? You can't know anything through the senses. How do you even know that that's a Bible that you have in your hand? And Gordon Clark responded by saying, what Bible? And you could hear, this is an old audio cassette, you could hear the whole audience go, oh, like they felt sorry for the guy. But Gordon Clark, he was actually accused later in life of being an idealist, somebody who believes that the physical world doesn't exist. Only ideas exist. It's kind of like, it's not a reality. We don't live in reality, we live in a virtual reality world. And you know what his response was? This was kind of sad. But he said, I only wrote on epistemology, not on metaphysics. And so what he's saying is, I only wrote about how we can know. I never got to the point. He wrote like 60 books or so. I never wrote about what is real. Well, I mean, two things. Number one, it's a very evasive move. Clark was the expert on evasive moves. Second thing, when you talk about your epistemology, your theory of knowledge, you reveal, you give really strong clues about your metaphysics. So I don't know. David Hoover, in fact, last I heard, he was teaching at Pierce Community College. He used to teach with him at Covenant College. Got a hold of me when he moved in the area, and I was just shocked because, you know, he debated Clark in 1981. In the 1990s, he got a hold of me, and, I shouldn't even say, I'll tell you this story during a break. I don't want this on the, this is a kind of a private matter. Shouldn't be. He told me something about Clark that I don't want to say. There's a lot of his followers, and I'll tell you during a break. But anyway, so then later his scripturalism. Well, now there's an awful lot of guys that are fans of Francis Schaeffer. I love Schaeffer stuff. If you haven't read Schaeffer, I call my students at Cross Point Academy the generation who knew not Schaeffer. Schaeffer was a man. I mean, he even looked like a thinker. You know, I look like some idiot jumped out of a cab in New Jersey. And Schaeffer looked like a thinker and a half, man. And but he was up there in the Swiss Alps at Le Brie doing his thing, him and his wife, Edith Schaeffer. And then you get like Edward J. Carnell. These guys are students of Van Til, and may have been it. Carnell was also a student of Gordon Clark. And so they thought they were presuppositionalists, but they made so many changes. In fact, even John Frame, still alive, California, they called him, like Frame called himself, presuppositionalist of the heart. Well, then he's not really a presuppositionalist. So with my heart, I presuppose. He said, well, if you're a Christian, you better. You better believe that God exists. That's not the point. We're asking how you argue, not what you believe. And, but their form of presuppositionalism, they open their presupposition to testing. So it's actually what I call verificationalism. Okay? It's a halfway house in between classical apologetics and presuppositionalism. It's not truly a presuppositional approach. Okay? It's kind of like hypothesis testing. You could, C.S. Lewis would fit in this category, and he wasn't even a Reformed scholar. Okay? Where, you know, C.S. Lewis talked about finding the truth is like finding the missing piece to a puzzle or finding the key that unlocks the door. Okay? But it's like an explanation that has a better fit with the data than any other explanation, and you test this hypothesis, you open it up for testing. Presuppositionalists won't open their presupposition for testing. They would view that as idolatry. This is why when Francis Schaeffer spoke at Westminster Seminary, Van Til refused to attend and waited in another room. And when Schaeffer got done, they said, the professor wants to talk to you. And he knew exactly who the professor was. And they brought him into a room with Van Til, and Van Til chewed him out for about an hour. And Francis Schaeffer, being the class guy that he was, said, professor, I really enjoyed what you had to say. I only wish we could have taped it. I would make it required listening for all my students at Le Brie. Schaeffer was a very tremendous man of character and respected his professor, but a verificationalist is not really a presuppositionalist. So I would classify these kind of as Reformed, kind of like Presbyterian methods. And I would add to the list Alvin Plantinga. God as a properly basic belief. Now he calls that, it's been called Reformed epistemology, and that's just not accurate. I mean, it's just, He's not saying what Calvin said. Calvin, these guys love claiming John Calvin. They're Calvinists. They love claiming John Calvin as their own. Well, if Calvin was a presuppositionalist, why did he talk about... Just read his Institutes. Immediate knowledge of God and mediate knowledge of God. See, this is what he called in Latin the sensus divinitatis, the sense of deity within all. So Calvin says, look, you think there's five senses? There's at least one more sense. God created us deep down inside with this sense of Him. Saint Bonaventure, the Roman Catholic scholar, lived during the time of Thomas Aquinas. He also believed in that sense of God that we have. But Bonaventure really spoke. He spoke more about it than Calvin did, as far as I know, and said that it's blurry, and man stifles it. And so that's why you need arguments for God's existence, because our sinfulness causes us to kind of, it's kind of like if you lost some of your hearing, you'd be hard of hearing. Well, we've all lost some of our spiritual sight.
Got a question.
Yeah.
So we mentioned Alvin Plantinga and mentioning God as a properly basic belief. What I've read of him sounds a lot like illuminationist epistemology. And I'm wondering, like, where's the distinction between them? Because he'll talk about the cognitive argument. If we were really just apes that evolved into humans, then my cognition will follow what evolution would tell me to do. I could be in this classroom right now in my mind, but in reality running away from a giant tiger because I'm just a caveman. There's no way for me to trust it. Therefore, since I believe in a good, truthful God, why not truly believe that? That's illuminationism.
Well, I'll, are you talking about like Augustine's illuminationism?
Or? No. Like Justin Martyr. In His Light, We See Light.
Yeah, His Light, We See Light, yeah. Yeah, and that's real close. That is close to Augustine's illumination. Plantinga, it's a totally different thing. I'll talk to that in one second. Let me just finish this thing on Calvin. But immediate, we have immediate knowledge of God, but mediate knowledge of God means there's something that mediates, something in the middle, the medium through which we can learn about God. So in other words, Calvin would say that we can learn that God exists by looking at nature. So Calvin is a very mild form of classical or evidential apologist. But I just brought this up, Calvin's sensus divinitatis, because Alvin Plantinga has gone out of the way saying God is a properly basic belief. He's not talking about the sensus divinitatis.
Yeah.
So he's not talking about deep down inside we all know that God exists. Now Plantinga might not even disagree with that. He's just saying, that's not what I'm saying, well, God is a properly basic belief. Properly basic beliefs would be a... here's things that philosophers have never been able to prove that a real world exists outside our minds. The existence of other minds. Okay? When you start examining things through the realm of the senses, you assume that it's not an illusion and there is a real world outside your mind. I mean, a good argument for a real world existing outside of your mind is the fact, try living like the world outside your mind isn't real. Okay? So try as you say, well, I'm going to walk right through that wall. And if I succeed, I'm not going to fall down because there is no down. I'm not going to hit the pavement because there is no pavement. I'm not going to eat food because there is no real food. So you can't live consistently with the denial of a real world existing outside our minds, but that still doesn't really prove it. Now for me, that's good enough. For a world-class philosopher, these are things we assume. And so with planning another philosopher, the existence of other minds. I sure hope other minds exist. Because I've been rambling on for an hour and a half now. And if no other minds exist, I'm just wasting my time. And, but we all exist. And this isn't even, you know, hate to be graphic, but if I took surgical equipment and cut open your skull and saw your brain, the brain is not a mind. The mind is the non-material soul that acts upon the brain. And but just assuming the existence of other minds that make choices, that think, that understand, these are just what planning on a lot of philosophers call properly basic beliefs. And Plantinga says, hey, you know what? And by the way, he was one of the world's leading philosophers. He's retired now. But he was a professor in their philosophy and religion department at Notre Dame, which was considered the world's leading philosophy and religion department when he was there. Now that he's gone, he probably doesn't hold the number one status anymore. But he says, well, I think belief in God can be properly basic. Now, he's not saying this descensus divinitatis in everybody, because like Hindus don't believe in a real world outside our minds. So even though it's properly basic, so if you believe in it, you are justified in believing in it without any evidence, you don't have to present any evidence for it. Okay? And so Plantinga just says, look, belief in God, I think, is properly basic. And so when he debates atheists on a topic, he just sits there, when they used to allow him, I think he used to smoke a pipe indoors, but they don't allow it anymore, but he just sits there with his arms folded. I think Anthony Flew debated him before Anthony Flew believed that God existed. There's like two or three atheists versus two or three Christians. And the guys in the crowd, you know how you kind of sometimes you're intimidated by the guys who are debating? The guys who are in the crowd are Gary Habermas, Liam Lane Craig. I mean, I'd be intimidated just sitting in the crowd. There are all these great thinkers. I think it was the Evangelical Theological Society meeting. But Plantinga, they said, no, I believe belief in God is properly basic. And so the Anthony Flew says, some evidence. I'm just asking for some evidence. And Plantinga is like, why? I just believe belief in God is a properly basic belief. You know, you're not going to give me evidence for a real world existing outside our minds or the existence of other minds. Why should I have to give you evidence for God? I'm justified in that. Now, what Plantinga is not saying is therefore throw out classical apologetics. Plantinga is probably considered the greatest living defender of the ontological argument for God's existence. If you don't know what that means, don't worry, we'll get to it later on in this course. He also is kind of fond of, I mean, he doesn't, he likes traditional arguments for God's existence. He just doesn't think they prove as much and with as much certainty as a lot of classical. So he has like a mild, humble form of classical and evidential apologetics. But he says, by the way, this evidence that I'm giving to you, I don't need to justify it. I believe belief in God is properly basic. So if I feel like doing that, I will. If I don't feel like doing that, I'll just fold my arms and say, why? Why do I need evidence to believe in God? I just know. J.P. Moreland, Scaling the Secular City, and Moreland doesn't hold to this, but he talks about like properly basic beliefs, something along the lines of, there's nothing wrong with saying, I believe torturing innocent babies is evil, even if I can't prove it. I just know it's evil. And Plantinga is saying, look, I know God exists. And I'm not going to give on that. And I don't need to give you any evidence. And so, in this Reformed camp, and it's even misleading, because there are a lot of Reformed scholars who are classical apologists. I would even say Calvin was a mild form of classical apologetics. R.C. Sproul, Gerstner, Lindsley. But having said that, most of the Reformed scholars today fall somewhere in this camp. Either God is a properly basic belief, but it's all arguing from God to everything else, or at least assuming God at the outset. Okay? And so you've got those approaches. Then I would say you've got... Oops, I want to keep that. Then you've got what I would call experiential approaches. Okay? For experiential approaches, you could take your experiences, testimonial apologetics, how Jesus changed your life, or how God answered your prayers. Okay? I have had numerous occasions in my life where me and the missus figured out, one time we figured out we needed exactly, you know, about $4,000 and they're like, well, Lord, you know, it'd be really nice if you just round it off to $5,000. You know, and I didn't know my wife said the same prayer. Then I get a check in the mail from my dad, who never had a dime in the bank. I didn't know, you know, he bought a house in New Jersey in 1964 for $18,000. I didn't know in 1985 he was going to sell it for $150,000. Then he was going to pay off what he owed, pay off his debts. He was going to take half of what was left and buy another house in Toms River, New Jersey, a senior citizen community, take the other half that was left and divide it up among his four kids. And I was one of them, and I didn't know he was going to send me a check in the mail for $5,000. When my wife got it, she was crying, and she said, I asked the Lord for exactly this amount. And I said, what amount? And she showed me a check for $5,000, and I was praying for that exact amount. And so we've got answered prayer. You know how we say sometimes that God answers prayer? You know, sometimes he says no, but sometimes he answers prayers at the very last moment. What I find is that there are sometimes we make a human deadline, and God doesn't make it. We were going to try to keep... kind of our big man on campus at our school. He's been through Christian education his whole life. He's been at our school for the last 6 years, and he's got a single mom. She just cannot afford it anymore. And so she needed so much help. We were able to raise $5,000. It wasn't enough. It got to the point where he needed another $2,500. We even called a few churches, and they couldn't help. Our church helped out. But it was like, wow. We're 2,500 short, and the mom said, if we don't know by this date, by the end of this day, you know, I'm just going to have to enroll them in Central Kitsap High School. So when I got the phone call from the last church that I had called, and they came back and said, yeah, our board said no, I thought that's it. So I went to go into the superintendent's office, Mr. Sweeney's office, to tell him the kid's not coming back. And the kid really wanted to come back too. Mr. Sweeney wasn't there. He had left early that day. So I figured I'll tell him first thing in the morning. So then I go home, I get on the computer, I get on Facebook, and in real time, one of his former buddies who had moved to Michigan, his dad texted me and said, I found out that so-and-so needs some help. I'm willing to pay up to $4,000, and blah, blah, blah. And we only needed $2,500. So it was after the deadline, and I called Mr. Sweeney that night. So, I mean, so testimony, apologetics, answered prayer, your own testimony, how God changed your life. But that's the scariest thing for me, sharing my testimony, because I am more than willing to air my dirty laundry before the world and say that Jesus changed me, and he's still working on me, and I still got other areas. But, you know, New Jersey, family is a big deal, community is a big deal. So I shared my testimony in 1984. That didn't want to share it anymore. Then I was interviewed by the Bremen Sun, and they said that my Cousin Vinny, they said he was in the mafia, and he wasn't, he never broke a law a day in his life. His dad was, they got confused. And so I always feel like I'm throwing somebody I love under the bus. And now you shared my testimony, and I still kind of feel icky. So I don't know if changing the names, so you don't throw your buddies under the bus. I don't know what you do, but whatever the case, testimonial apologize. Man, we have some of the testimony of people who say, like Nabil Qureshi, who now has stomach cancer, and was saved out of Islam. Abdul Murray, saved out of Islam. Michael Brown, saved out of Judaism. You know, I mean, the list goes on and on of these radical conversions. Guys who get saved out of the homosexual lifestyle. And so in my book, I'll have a chapter on it where I'll share a little bit. Guru, a young guru who gets saved. And the book was titled The Death of a Guru. And the experiential apologetics, testimonial, there's psychological apologetics of like Blaise Pascal. Where Pascal is not appealing to a man's reason to prove that Christianity is true. He thinks that he has, contrary to popular belief, Blaise Pascal was not an irrationalist. He was a great mathematician. He loved geometry. He was very much thumbs up on reason. His disagreement with Rene Descartes said man is a rational being, period. Pascal said man is a rational being, comma. We're not just a rational machine, there's other things, emotions, the will, our desires. And Pascal says, it wasn't that he didn't trust reason, he didn't trust fallen, sinful man to use his reason in an honest manner. So Pascal says most of the decisions we make in life, we make those decisions by something other than reason, and then we sneak reason in the back door to defend what we already believe because we want to believe it. So I can make a really strong case that Kent Stabler was the greatest quarterback in NFL history, and that it's a good thing they finally put him in the Hall of Fame. It's too bad he died before they put him in there. Well, does the fact that I've been a Raider fan since 1967 have anything to influence my thought? Probably. So Pascal would say, well, it's your love for the Raiders that makes you use, you didn't come through reading. I mean, it's like Joe Montana won 4 Super Bowls. Brady won 4 Super Bowls. Of course, Brady, you can make a good case as part of the system. So he wins 4 Super Bowls, but in a year when they're undefeated and he's injured, they keep winning with an unknown backup quarterback. So it's probably more Belichick than Brady. Whereas Peyton Manning, I don't even like the guy, but the Colts go 14-2 with him. He gets injured, and then they go 2-14 without him. I think he makes a bigger difference. So the fact that he has less Super Bowls than Brady is probably was part of an organization that wasn't as squared away. But whatever the case, Pascal would say, yeah, that's the way we humans are. So what Pascal says is, I'm going to get you, you're either going to be biased against God or biased for God before you even look at the historical evidence for Christianity. Pascal, in his view, it's kind of weird on the traditional arguments for God. He said, arguments for God, it's his work, Ponce's. You go to Barnes & Noble and buy it. Go to a Christian bookstore, you probably won't find it. He was writing a book defending the faith, and then he died at the age of 39. If he lived to be 89, we'd be having this lecture on Mars right now. That's how brilliant he was and how much he impacted his world. But on traditional arguments for God, he said, look, even if the arguments are valid, and he kind of wondered if they were. But even if they're valid, only a really brilliant guy or gal is going to be able to follow that line of reasoning and be convinced that God exists. But even if they're convinced that God exists, they're no longer a hellbound atheist, now they're a hellbound theist. Because they haven't come to Jesus yet. But more than likely, by the next day, they're going to forget the force of the argument, and then they'll go back to being an atheist again. So, let's just look. Even if you convince people of God's existence through rational arguments, they're still not a Christian. Let's get right to historical evidences for Jesus. But when people examine the evidence for Jesus, they're going to use their reason in either a bias, they're going to be biased towards Jesus or biased against him. So Pascal says, okay, so let's look at it. You're going to have to wager your life. If you don't wager your life, that's as good as wagering against God. But you're either going to have to wager that God exists or wager that he doesn't exist. Now, he's not saying, this is not an argument for God's existence. This is an argument that you should hope that God exists and seek him with all your heart. This is why Blaise Pascal says only two kinds of people can be called wise. Those who seek God with all their hearts because they don't know him, and those who serve God with all their hearts because they do know him. Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Bertrand Russell, Jean-Paul Sartre, they're fools. You can have a lot of knowledge and still be a fool if you're going to wager your life against God. Why? Because if you wager your life against God, you've got the possibility of there's nothing to gain, no possibility of gain, yet there's the possibility of infinite loss. If you wager your life that God exists, you seek God with all your heart, you hope that a God who rewards those who seek him actually exists. If you wager your life on God, you have the possibility of infinite gain and no possibility of loss. You know, I heard a philosophy professor from Biola University, from Talbot School of Theology at Biola, who once said that Pascal's wager only works if the evidence for and against God are even. And I disagreed with him, but I didn't want to embarrass him, so I waited for the talk to be done. And after the talk was done, I said, Dr. So-and-so, if I could talk to you for a minute, and I told him about Richard Creel, a philosopher, said, look, your two-year-old child gets lost in the woods. The sheriff starts, it's a search party, they get a lot of volunteers, hundreds of people, and they're out there looking for your child for 48 hours. And it's cold out there. And the sheriff comes up to you and says, look, there's only a 1% chance that your child is still alive. Can we call off the search? What are you going to tell him?
No.
No. Because there's nothing to lose by searching an extra day and everything to gain. If that 1% chance is actualized and my child is still alive. And, well, God is even infinitely more valuable than that. And so if there's any possibility of God existing, the wise man will seek him if he doesn't know him already. So Richard Dawkins is not being wise. And so there's psychological apologetics. I'll put narrative apologetics in there. This is basically because people don't want to listen to us defending the faith or sharing the gospel. Let's tell them stories that point them in the direction of Jesus. I would like to see, I love Christian movies, and I love Christians and want to get the word out there, but Americans do not want to be preached at anymore. You mentioned Greg Kokel's book on tactics. He knows people don't want... Americans hate to be preached at, but they have an opinion about everything, even things they know nothing of, okay? So, why not witness to them by asking questions? I saw a show on the Ancient Aliens, talking about these aliens building the pyramids. What do you think about that? I mean, you start asking people, they'll share, even if a guy's never had an opinion, he'll make it up as he goes along. And then you start asking, huh, well, why do you believe that? Huh, well, how do you know that's true? Okay, so nobody wants to be preached at, but everybody's got an opinion they want to share. And you can end up building a friendship by caring enough to listen to people and build a relationship. And then eventually, in those situations, you can get to the point, I've been there before, where a guy says, well, you know, you seem to be really smart. It's weird. Where did they say that? Because sometimes they'll tell you after two meetings, you seem to know a lot of stuff. And it's like, all I've done is ask questions. I haven't said anything. You know, what's your view? And usually I'll get to the point, so I don't want to tell you because you'll think I'm a narrow-minded bigot. No, I won't. I think we're becoming friends, man. What do you believe? You know, but I get them to beg me, and then I share Jesus with them, and they look at me like, you jerk, you know. If I had known you were a Christian, you know, now I can't call you a bigot. But whatever the case, tell them a story. But I'd like to see Christian filmmakers watch I Am Legend very slowly and take notes. How many people have seen I Am Legend? Okay. Did you see the Christian themes throughout it or not? Most of my kids thought it was just an action flick. And it was one of my students. She later went to Princeton, almost a full scholarship. But when I was slamming the kids for the music they listened to, she said, I guess, and she started crying, she was convicted. I guess what you're saying is we're educated the most when we think we're being entertained. And, but I Am Legend, I mean, when there's something on a refrigerator door, and Will Smith is going to open a refrigerator door, it's not by accident that it's on a refrigerator door. The producer put it there. The director put it there. And it's like, I don't know, cover of Newsweek or Time Magazine with Will Smith on the cover. He's a scientist, and it says Savior. And then in different color ink, there's a question mark. So it leads you to believe he put the question mark. So can science save us? Well, guess what? The movie starts out, science found a cure for cancer. Unfortunately, the cure for cancer turns into a virus that turns people into monsters. So science can solve some of our problems, but there's no salvation in science. And he was a guy that believed in God. He prayed with his wife and his daughter. But then when they died, he lost his faith in God. Real interesting conversation happens when that lady who believes in God, and she's got a butterfly tattoo, which his daughter had told him, remember the butterfly, Daddy, remember the butterfly. And a butterfly is symbolic of regeneration, okay? And, but the lady with the butterfly tattoo that is a Christian is arguing with him about this mutated lady who is strapped in his lab, and he's running tests, and by the way, the salvation is in the blood. They're arguing about the lady that's strapped down in the lab, and she's one of these monsters, and he refers to the lady as an it numerous times, while she refers to the lady as a she or a her. And I don't know what the producer's trying to say if he's not trying to say this. Your view of God is going to determine your view of humanity. If you don't believe in God, then some human beings can be so disabled that they're subhumans, and they're its, what Hitler called useless eaters, okay? Eating food that healthy Aryans could be eating. But if you believe in God, then no matter how disabled a human being is, they are still a human being who's created in God's image, and still have lives of infinite value. And then when the guy's banging his head, the leader of the mutant guys or whatever, I didn't even see it until like the third or fourth time I watched it, because I had to take notes for it. I thought, Course in Christianity film, and the cracks form into a butterfly. And then when the lady goes with her son to their final community, the gated community of people who weren't infected, they open the door, the first thing you see is a white church with its steeple and stuff like that. But that would be an example of narrative apologetics. And it's not in your face. The guy doesn't even play, and by the way, I don't even know if the guy's a Christian, but he chose Christian themes. Okay? And so the music that's in the movie is not in-your-face Christian music. It's Rastafarian, Bob Marley. But the themes are similar enough to keep the Christian narrative going. Sometimes when Jesus was teaching the people, and he said, look, I want them to accept what I'm teaching them, so rather than give them rational arguments, I'm going to tell them stories. Okay? And now there's a lot of postmodern Christians that they want to tell stories, but they don't want any propositional truth behind the stories. That's not even Christian. Okay? But if you can tell stories like C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien or Bunyan, it's Pilgrim's Progress, that teach Christian truth. You know, C.S. Lewis probably led more skeptics to Christ through his Chronicles of Narnia than he did through his philosophical works. Okay? And he knew that, and he wasn't ashamed of that at all. And some people will never listen to a defense of the faith. But they like to hear a story. And another one wrote a petition, I don't have time to get into it. That's another one with Christian themes. When Paul Newman and Tom Hanks are arguing, they're mafia guys, and they're arguing, there's usually a crucifix in the background. And Tom Hanks, you know, Paul Newman says to Tom Hanks, well, we're all going to hell anyway. And Tom Hanks says, but not Michael. His son's name is Michael, which means one who is like God. He says, but not Michael. Paul Newman says, what? He says, but not Michael. There's still hope for Michael. And so the road to perdition means the road to hell. He's trying to take him to a city of perdition, but at the end of the movie, the son goes off the road to perdition, goes off that road. The whole movie is about a father who knows he's going to hell and doesn't want his son going to hell too. And most people watch it just think it is a bloody movie. It's not. I wouldn't take the kids to it. And I think Tom Hanks would convince me he could be a hitman. He's too nice of a guy. I want him to be my next door neighbor. But I don't think he could afford to live in my community. But he not only convinced me he was a hitman, he convinced me he was the most professional hitman in the game. But there's an example. Signs. Whenever they repeat something twice, they're telling you something. In Signs, the aliens are landing, and the kid says, now everything they taught us about science, now everything's got to change. And then the television set comes on, and the news reporter says almost the exact same thing. It appears that everything that we were taught in school about science was incorrect and has got to be changed, and blah, blah, blah. And that whole movie is that, look, in postmodern times, we don't know which way is up. And traditional religion, we need to put the crosses back on the wall. Preacher needs to put his collar back on. Traditional religion has a place at the table. But we Americans, we just sit down and watch movies and we don't even think about what we're seeing. But those would be examples of narrative apologetics. And I wish we saw a little bit more of that. So you've got reformed methods, you've got the traditional arguing from something to God, you've got experiential methods, and then you got what I would call comparative religious apologetics, like Walter Martin refuting the cults, Winfried Cordovan, or Josh McDowell and Don Stewart, dealing with world religions. And then the occult, dealing with the occult and New Age movement. Right now, what I'm calling paranormal apologetics. You know, statues that cry tears or bleed. Mm-hmm. The stigmata, people getting the supernaturally getting the wounds of Christ. You know, we need to respond to that. And by the way, there's so many Protestants who say, yeah, the stigmata is demonic. And then 5 minutes later, they're talking to me about St. Francis of Assisi. St. Francis was the first guy who got the stigmata. So if it's automatically demonic, then let's question whether or not St. Francis really was a saint. If St. Francis really was a saint, then we've got to be open to that. Now, I myself, my father had been a Franciscan monk, 5 separate 1-year vows, and he never took a vow for life, so he was in good standing when he left, met my mom, rest is history. But he thinks St. Francis is a good guy, so he liked Padre Pio, the Italian priest who had the stigmata, most famous 20th century stigmata case. The guy had people kneeling down in front of him, kissing his wounds. He promised people he would suffer for them so they'd spend less time in purgatory. I don't think it's from God, and so I question St. Francis. Now, if you had all the leading Christian apologists in this room right now who question the sainthood of St. Francis, I'd probably still be alone. You know, what I'm saying isn't really popular, but I don't see God getting the glory from that, okay? And I think these are all the different ways. Yep, those are all the ways that I've got listed. Now, you can see in your notes, there's a picture of Blaise Pascal. Good-looking guy. It's like a pinky with hair. There's C.S. Lewis, Francis Schaeffer, Robbie Zacharias is just brilliant. Oh, yeah, that's the one thing I left out, cultural apologetics. My God, government, the road to tyranny. A chapter there on the death of Western civilization. I have another chapter on the religious impact on government and stuff like that. Those are cultural apologetics, where I'm arguing for the superiority of the Christian worldview when applied to a culture. When Christianity is applied to a culture, the culture tends to prosper, and you have freedom maximized. When atheism or New Age pantheism is applied to cultures, you see a lot of bloodshed, okay? The Robbie Zacharias is real good on cultural apologetics. Just listening to his voice, he's, you know, from India originally, his family, and he was born in a line of priests, but then came to Christ. And there's William Lane Craig, and Gordon Clark and Van Til, they hated each other. I'm not even exaggerating. Van Til blocked Gordon Clark's ordination. It was ugly. And Gary Habermas, well, prop, he started the guy's big as a moose. He started the hockey team at Liberty University. And Norman Geisler, Geisler's getting up in years, about 84 now. He was born in 1932. I just worked on a book with him, Vital Issues in the Inerrancy Debate. Walter Martin, he started the Christian Research Institute in Wayne, New Jersey, when I was a non-believer. I didn't even know about him, but he wrote The Kingdom of the Cults. And then Henry Morris, a great scientific apologist, wrote the Genesis Record and the co-authored the Genesis Flood. So let's take a break now. Those are just some of the... We defined apologetics, and we talked about different ways to defend the faith. And in the next lecture, we'll respond to Finneyism and give the biblical basis for Christian apologetics.